Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Back in 1963, I hung out in a dive bar, the only club in Topeka that didn't card me. On the night President Kennedy was assassinated, I spotted Dylan John, though back then he was still Arthur Devane, standing with his back against a brick wall in the far end of the room, glaring at the tenor saxophone player. This is G.P. Gottlieb, host for New Books in Literature, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today I'm talking to Richard Falco. His novel, We Are All Together, tells the story of the rise and fall of a rock band, along with its members and hangers-on. Dylan John, the young megastar who fronts a band called Red Afternoon, walks away before a major show, and guitarist Stephen Kane gets the opportunity of a lifetime to step into Dylan's shoes. It's 1967, and while the country is in turmoil, Stephen makes some bad choices that affect his career and nearly cost him his life. He tells the story of his personal rise and fall, recalling an abusive father, an almost deadly drug addiction, a crazy girlfriend and her scary cult, and his descent from potential rock star to rock bottom. Hi, Richie. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Galit. Thanks for inviting me.
So how did you come to write We Are All Together?
Well, I used to write a music blog called Riff Raff, and when I was doing some research on psychedelic music, I came across information on the Pink Floyd. And I grew up listening to Pink Floyd. I wouldn't say I was a fan of Pink Floyd. I do like some of their music. But I didn't know too much about Syd Barrett, who was the founder of Pink Floyd and the primary songwriter and the visionary and lyricist and guitar player. And I didn't know too much about him at the time, other than he was kind of the focus of the movie The Wall, which I had seen when I was really young. It kind of really intrigued me, but freaked me out a little bit, especially the part where Syd starts to lose his mind. And so I did some research on Syd Barrett. I had a student once talked to me about Syd Barrett, and I didn't know very much about him. And then in the research, I was really drawn to some of the stories of Pink Floyd. For instance, one of the stories that really captured my interest was Syd being at the height of his success in Pink Floyd's first record, kind of checked out. And we don't know if he was an acid casualty or if he just didn't want to be involved in popular music anymore. He had enough, or he wanted to go solo. And that just really intrigued me, that somebody at the, you know, in their prime, at the peak of their powers, might just check out. So I went with that kind of like essential question, you know, what did Sid do? Did, you know, was he an acid casualty? Did he just check out? Did he no longer want to be a musician? Had he had enough? And that kind of guided me in the early drafts of the novel.
Wow. So is Stephen based on an actual musician? And if not, what's his backstory?
Stephen is based on me, but not, you know, it's Sid is based on Dylan John, Stephen's bandmate and collaborator is based on Sid. So Stephen is, you know, I was a musician for a long time, and I used a few of my stories in there. I didn't use as many as I had hoped. You know, the question that surrounds Stephen is, to what extent will a musician go, or an artist will go, to achieve success or greatness? And in the end, you know, Stephen's willing to do just about anything to be successful.
Yeah. It's not clear how Stephen learns to play lead guitar, or why he has such a fraught relationship with music. How did you envision that?
Well, one thing I did rely on was a story, you know, something from my childhood. I was around 10, and there were a lot of garage bands in the neighborhood. And I remember watching one through the fence. It was like, you know, a bunch of teenagers and all teenagers hanging out. They didn't want to, you know, a 9-10-year-old kid hanging out with them. So I remember just watching through the fence. And I distinctly remember the band playing Come Together by the Beatles. And I remember being so like excited by it. You know, I just was thrilled by it. And that was, you know, Stephen's introduction. Although Stephen was a child in the 50s. So the band that he had seen, he was just very excited by rock and roll, and motivated to learn the guitar. Part of it was because of the girls in the audience. Part of it was he just wanted to be cool, and he was looking for something to provide him with some focus. And he ends up playing with that band. So he's motivated to learn guitar. He's motivated to be in a band. He's motivated to become a rock star. Whereas Dylan is, I think, really interested in being a musician.
Stephen thinks that his best friend Dylan is more talented than he is. Your quote is, "Although he couldn't shred like me, he produced amazing licks and riffs I could only dream of playing." Can you say more?
I think Stephen recognizes, as every character in the book recognizes, that Dylan is a genius and that Dylan is an artist. Dylan's question is, what's his role in society? You know, how important is the artist during a tumultuous period of the 60s? Stephen recognizes that Dylan is just a creator, an inventor of a music form. He's the pioneer of psychedelic music. Stephen can play guitar. He could play chords. He could play power chords. He could do all kinds of scales. He could do runs up and down the neck. He could shred. Dylan is creator. So Dylan, you know, writes the songs, writes the lyrics, writes the music. He arranges the music, and then essentially tells Stephen what to play, even how to play it. I think Dylan can play quite well, but that was also that quote was kind of taken from David Gilmour, who was a guitar player in Pink Floyd, who ends up replacing Sid in the band. And David and the rest, Roger Waters and the rest of the band, all recognized that Sid was this, you know, genius songwriter. And but there were times where Sid didn't want to play guitar in performances, live performances, when he was going through some difficult times emotionally. He refused to play guitar. You know, there's one time where he just like removed all the strings from his guitar one night, or he just stood there. And they hired David to play guitar in case Sid didn't want to play guitar. And David Gilmour is a songwriter, but I think he's known primarily as a guitar player, a great guitar player who could shred like Stephen.
Can you describe for people who aren't in the know, what do you mean by shred?
Well, I play in a few bands and guitar players, and they talk about shredding. I don't think I've ever really played with guitar players who could shred. Maybe one or two. Most of them were rhythmic players who can solo. But I think of shredders. Maybe that's more of like a. Maybe I got the term wrong, but more of like an '80s. It reminds me. I get the image of like a heavy metal guitar player. You know, someone who's playing the notes. Amazing things, with dexterity, I guess, in the fingers and able to go up and down the neck with just, you know, with relative ease. Someone who shreds at one point in the novel, Stephen is talking to a kid on the street and they're talking about guitar players and the kid says he prefers guitar players who aren't really guitar players who could shred, because if you could shred, you're not listening to the rest of the band. I mean, this is what the kid said. I don't know if I agree with him, that those the players who aren't so fluent in the guitar playing are listening more to the rest of the band, listening to what the rest of the band has to do, what the rest of the band is doing. So, yeah, that's my definition of shredding. I hope.
That's interesting. It sounds kind of like a fabulous improvisation.
Yeah.
That's it. Mm-hmm. Okay. Stephen says his and Dylan's lives were changed when they saw the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show, February 9th, 1964. I always insist that the Beatles were followed by Topo Gigio, the Little Mouse, but there are people who argue. Do you have any comments on that?
Musicians, especially rock musicians, there's so many of them, so that when they saw the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show, it changed their lives. How many bands were formed, you know, as a result of their appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show. I've watched that quite a bit. I wasn't born at the time, but I'm a big Beatles fan. And you know, the excitement and the enthusiasm that they generated as a band is just unparalleled, in my opinion. It's just people got swept away by so many things about that band, not just the sound of the music, which was completely unique, but they were a four-piece band. There was no necessarily leader, although John Lennon and Paul McCartney were more of the leaders, but they were a band. The way they looked, their haircuts, the way they dressed, the instruments that they played, what's a Hofner bass, what's a Rickenbacker guitar, these Vox amps that they're playing. And then, you know, the other band that's in the book is the Velvet Underground, which is another band that, you know, spawned, you know, a multitude of bands after they were privy to the Velvet Underground. Stephen and Dylan watched the Beatles on Ed Sullivan's show, and immediately they get the Beatle haircuts and they trade in their leather jackets and all their leather for suits and ties, and they try to emulate their favorite mop tops.
Yes, I remember all the boys doing that. Can you say more about how Stephen is always changing his focus?
I think it's kind of a theme that runs throughout the novel. It's not just Stephen. I think it's Emily, and I think it's Dylan. I think it's Tony Campbell, who's a minor character in the book. Young people trying to find an identity, young people trying to find their way in the world, trying to find out who they are and willing to try different things on for size, you know, So I think, you know, Steven's willing to do anything to be a musician, to be a full-time musician, and to be a success, and to show his parents that he could become successful and he could do things on his own and he doesn't need their help. And I think he's also trying to kind of seek some revenge in a way against his parents. But, you know, I mean, Dylan is, you know, he's mercurial too. You know, he's changing his look constantly. I just think it's a part of life. I just think that's what young people do. And they are very young. I mean, Dylan is, you know, only 18 throughout most of the book, and then he's 19. And that's when he kind of steps back from the music. And Steven's only 21 years old. And, you know, in my eyes, they're really babies.
You mentioned Tony Campbell. Is he evil or just trying to make a living?
He's an opportunist. And I think, you know, in 1967, I think that's when the business people figured out that rock and roll was going to stick around for a little bit. It had already been around for several years, and they were trying to figure out how to make money off rock and roll. And he's one. He's, you know, he's at the forefront. So he's an opportunist, and he's going to seize any opportunity to make some money. But he's also written Dylan's autobiography. So he's a great marketer, whereas a lot of novelists or writers aren't very good at marketing their abilities. He is, and he's able to parlay that into a business, Peace, Love, and Groove. And he's, you know, he has his book and he has his clothing line, and he's going to do whatever it takes to earn a dollar in this world.
Two other minor characters are worth mentioning. Brian Jennings, he plays a big role in Steven's life, and also Seth Friedman. Can you say something about those two?
Yeah, I know. Brian Jennings, I was thinking about Brian I got from, like, Brian Epstein, the Beatles manager, but he was not Brian Epstein. He was not remotely close to Brian Epstein. I saw Brian Jennings as someone who also saw an opportunity. I guess Brian Epstein saw an opportunity in the Beatles and capitalized on that. That he had a band and he thought the band had promise, but particularly Dylan. And you know, there's the kind of hints about he wanting Dylan to go solo so he could manage Dylan's career and not have to deal with the band. And that is a sore spot for Seth, who Seth Friedman, who kind of takes over where Steven leaves the band. Actually, Steven and Dylan have a Everly Brothers kind of outfit group. And when Steven leaves Dylan to join another band, that's when Seth kind of steps in and is like Dylan's right-hand man. And he's just trying to keep everything together. And he's just trying to get the band to record their first album. And he knows that Dylan is dealing with a lot of psychological issues, and he's desperate. He sees his career failing, and he sees his life falling apart as a result. So he's just really desperate, and he's also envious of Dylan and envious that jealous that Brian Jennings wants to run Dylan's career, and he doesn't really care about the rest of the band. Red Afternoon is Dylan John's band.
Mm-hmm. Why did you make Steven's father such an abusive, controlling, racist, and bigot? did I describe that correctly?
Yeah. I certainly did. I don't know why I did it. I think I needed something to for Steven, who's not the most likable character in the beginning of the book. I needed the readers to see the pain that he was experiencing from his father and how he was raised from his, you know, by his father, who was an abusive alcoholic. And so I thought that gave Steven something that the readers could sympathize with. Stephen's kind of a misogynist and an opportunist, as I keep mentioning, and he's willing to betray his best friend, and he does betray his best friend. He has problems with faith and loyalty, and he's kind of a ne'er-do-well, and he's not the brightest bulb necessarily. And, you know, I needed something to some background for Stephen. So when he gets to New York, we know that he has a broken heart. He was in a relationship with a woman who was married, and she broke his heart. And he had this abusive father and a mother who's rather religious that he just didn't see eye to eye with, and stuff that he had to deal with that, you know, I mean, parents aren't always supportive of a child's dreams and aspirations. And I think he's wrestling with that. You know, he was at odds with his parents, who don't really want him to pursue music, even though he has talent.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah. You describe Emily as beautiful, ethereal almost, but Stephen sees something wrong with her from the minute they meet. What's going on with that relationship?
Yeah, you know, I wanted Emily to be this paradoxical character. I wanted her to be this, you know, person who says she's rather new agey and Buddhist and doesn't really practice what she preaches. So when he meets her on the street, he's busking, her beauty's really evident, and has a broken heart. So she puts some money into his hat or his guitar case, and he doesn't want her to go. So he starts singing a song for her, and they end up going back to her place. She's also an amazing artist. So Stephen recognizes how gifted she is. And that makes him envious and jealous, just the way he's envious and jealous of Dylan, that here's this really talented painter. And unschooled, really. She hasn't really gone to school. But then she makes, you know, these anti-Semitic comments, and Stephen's really put off by them, and he's ready to leave. But he's so hurt and enchanted by her, and he's also high because they're like smoking pot. And, you know, so he's high, and he ends up staying with her. But he's conflicted all throughout the novel about his feelings for her, his attraction to her. And she keeps luring him in because, you know, on one hand, she says these rather wise, insightful things, and he's drawn to her wisdom. And then, you know, then she'll throw an offhanded, you know, anti-Semitic remark, or, you know, a kind of anti-black comment, and then he's ready to leave. But he recognizes that, but he's also young and willing to, like, just get his rocks off with her and overlook some of these things. But I think in the end, he really resents that, regrets. Mm-hmm.
Yep, I agree. So, it's so interesting. It was really a fascinating book because you brought us back to this really turbulent time in the 20th century in America. And I'm wondering how you can follow up a book like this. What are you working on next?
Well, you know, my first book, There Is No End to the Slope, deals with a middle-aged man who's a writer or wannabe writer. And it's kind of like coming a middle-aged story. And We're All Together is another first person point of view of a young man who's trying to become something. And the new book is tentatively, I'm calling it Fat Elvis, deals with a young person who's a high school person, first person, who's trying to find his way, trying to, he's a poet. So trying to make writing more of his way out of where he was brought up. So my first book is set right after 9/11, 2002 to 2003. We're All Together is 1967 through 1968. And my new book is 1984. Although it kind of started at 1979, but I'm still working on it. 1980s. And I wanted it to be the period where like rock music was really struggling, and pop music was really at the forefront, you know, Michael Jackson and Madonna and a lot of that popular music at the time. And that kind of captures my character in the middle and kind of limbo. And he's drawn to this other character who they nicknamed Fat Elvis. He's overweight and he's an Elvis fan. He's a big fan of Elvis Presley. So they have this relationship, and Mike, the character, the protagonist, his name is Timmy. Timmy learns a great deal about himself through Fat Elvis.
Cool. It sounds interesting. Thank you so much for talking to me today. It's been really fun and interesting, and I wish you well.
Thank you, Glee. Thanks for having me.
Again, thank you for joining me. This is G.P. Gottlieb, author of the Whipped and Sipped Mystery Series and host for New Books in Literature, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today, I've been talking to Richard Falco about his new novel, We Are All Together. Hope you all have a good, juicy book to cuddle up with today. Happy reading, everyone.